Tonight on Arena with me, Evelyn O'Rourke. Smith's drummer Mike Joyce's memoir, Hath Hell No Fury Like a Woman Scorned, and the beautiful game The Art It Inspires. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 087-032-3232. Email us to arena@rte.ie, and we're on the Instagram at @rte_arena. Yesterday, in the dying seconds of that football match on a freezing day in Budapest, Troy Parrott scored a winning goal and the Republic of Ireland team reignited a fire in the national soul, reminding us of the euphoric days of Italian 90. But what does this mean for us as a people? What cultural impact will it send through our literature, our music, our communities in the years ahead? We're thinking of Saipan the movie opening on Stephen's Day, telling that story. Roddy Doyle's The Van, for example. Christy Moore and all those songs, particularly Jocks Are Going to Stuttgart. And few people will understand what that impact could be better than Lyric FM's George Hamilton, who was the voice of football in our living room for 40 years whenever Ireland dared to dream. And he was, of course, the man that coined the phrase, the nation holds its breath, back in January 1990. Delighted to say we've George on the line. But before we talk to George, let's throw back to that famous line, that moment when everybody was just glued to what was going to happen on the football pitch.
But who's stepping up to assume the task? David O'Leary of Arsenal. In his 52nd international appearance, David O'Leary is entrusted with the responsibility of taking the penalty that could send Ireland into the quarterfinals of the World Cup. This kick can decide it all. The nation holds its breath. Yes, we're there!
George Hamilton, you're very welcome. I have to laugh when I hear that. But it really struck me today. All day long, people have been grappling for words and phrases. And we just heard the wonderful commentary there from Adrian and the team yesterday. And the music and the montages of music. The power of music and word on a moment like this. What is your reflection on that? What are your thoughts around that?
It's something that's culturally so significant, because if you think of it, the beautiful game, association football, soccer, call it what you will, it's the world's game. Everybody can understand it. Everybody is into it. And when it's your country doing well at it, it lifts the mood everywhere. We can think of the Germans in 2006 when they hosted the World Cup, which was the first time a united Germany had the chance to fly the German flag with pride. And they did so all the way through that tournament. That's what it did to a big, big nation like Germany. Think of what it did in 1990 to the Irish, to the much smaller nation that had never before Euro 88 had the chance to parade itself in front of a bigger audience. Euro 88 was like a rehearsal. It was like something I'd never experienced before, seeing all those green shirts marching into a stadium, seeing in Hanover a German guy wearing the Irish green shirt, because the Germans weren't going to be nearby when they were playing in the Euros. And these German guys turning up in their local stadium were supporting the underdog, the Irish, the new guys. To see green like that in a European context, and then 2 years later, to see it on the world stage. And it wasn't just a week of football that the Euros were, an 8-team tournament. It was the knockouts to the group stage, into the knockout stage, and on into the quarterfinal. We dared to dream, and it lasted, and it lasted. And suddenly, in the last eight of the World Cup, there was Ireland. And there was a rocket launching pad to send up an awareness of the country. And it was grasped by the people who were there in Italy. And it was turned into a cultural phenomenon that grew and grew. And Ireland, on the world stage, thanks to that football team, could never be the same again.
No, and we saw that confidence, you know, crept into so many areas of life. But we know culturally, you know, we talk about this green wave now, the actors, the writers, the novelists. There's a sense that so much happened in that moment back in 1990, and indeed, as you say, 1988, that fed into so many different parts of Irish society. But I'm thinking about, you know, Roddy Doyle writing The Van, or Aikino packing the theatres, football becoming literature. Do you think the writers, the filmmakers, the songwriters will be reaching for their notebooks from what they've seen over the last few days? Because it just feels like the colour, the drama is there, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it brought back so many memories when I was watching that game and seeing Troy Parrott score that hat-trick, the very first hat-trick scored by an Irish player abroad. Think of that. Think of the impact that that has had on the national psyche. You know, all these little bricks in the wall to become this monument to the success of the Irish team, which has not had success at all times. My goodness, don't we know it. Troy Parrott was only 4 months old when Ireland were last in the World Cup. Back in 2002. I don't see any reason why not, why they the pens shouldn't be raised, why the instruments shouldn't be raised, why the voices shouldn't be raised, and why there shouldn't be an artistic and cultural reflection of what has happened. You know, it was brought home to me way back in 1992 when I arrived in Sweden for the European Championship that Ireland didn't qualify for, and I turned up at the accreditation centre in Stockholm, and on my way in, I met a colleague and friend from the BBC, Mike Ingham, and he said to me, I've just been reading about you. And I said, what do you mean? He was reading The Van. He was reading Roddy Doyle's story of the World Cup in 1990. And that's the impact that it had. And my mate from the BBC was laughing his way through Roddy Doyle's account of the guys in the van. And I turned up in there, and Eamon Dunphy turned up in there, and we all turned up in there because it had such an impact, and it was such a wonderful thing. And I don't see any reason why not. We can't lose the run of ourselves. You know, we have only reached the playoff, and there are two more matches to be won to actually get to the World Cup. But when you think Ireland have won their last three in a row, why not? Why not make it five in a row and get to the States and Canada and Mexico or wherever the draw sends us?
So this is the dare to dream bit. Well, then I'm thinking about the music. Like my gang this weekend, do you know what they were doing? They were immediately looking for music to express their emotion. You know, they didn't even know they were doing that, but they were digging out. They were asking about the Christy Moore stuff, and they were even giving a lash jack. Got a run out in the car radio this morning. They just wanted the music. Isn't it? It's about the power of music to tell the next part of the story, isn't it?
Oh, let me tell you about Saturday morning. There I was on Lyric, presented the programme. I got a text from Sinead Wilde, who's the head of Lyric FM. She said, George, this weekend of sport is so big. And I had been talking about it. She said, why don't you get out that recording of Olé, Olé, Olé? And I knew exactly what she meant. It's a track called Football Anthems. Gavin Maloney, the conductor, has arranged a series of football anthems around Olé, 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 and You'll Never Beat the Irish and all that. And he got New Dublin Voices to sing it under Bernie Sherlock. And they sang with the RTE Concert Orchestra. And I played that. And you would not believe the reaction that I got. And that isn't actually classical music, because there's classical music that can lift the spirits as well. Like, for me, in moments like this, it's the overture to the Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, because you've settled into your chair in the opera house and up strikes the orchestra and you hear these wonderful strains and you know from the music that you're hearing that this is going to be quite the night at the opera. And it's the same thing with the music. And even if you think back to the World Cup and what started the 1990 World Cup was, of course, the three tenors. And Nessun Dorma became like a signature tune to the World Cup right around the globe. Music is every music lifts you, and of course, Christine Moore and Joxer. You know, music is such a central part of the Irish experience. And I'm sure, as Darren Maloney said in the commentary, there'd be songs written about this, songs written about what happened, the turnaround that there was when Heimar Hallgrímsson's team qualified for the playoffs and put the World Cup within touching distance again.
And it sounds like you'll be the man playing that soundtrack on your show. George, thank you so much for going down memory lane for us this evening. Really appreciate it so much. And you, thanks very much to George. Of course, you can hear George on the Hamilton Scores on Lyric FM on Saturday and Sunday mornings from 10 o'clock. And like we were saying, so much of the work inspired by football, but I have to say, watch out for Saipan, the movie hitting cinemas on December the 26th. That, I can tell you, will be a real treat. You were listening to The Marriage of Figaro there, the choice of George Hamilton to try and anyway get a soundtrack for what we saw on the pitch there yesterday. And you are listening to Monday Night's Arena.
You start to recoil, heavy words are so lightly thrown, but still I leap in front of a flying bullet for you. So what difference does it make? So what difference does it make? It makes none, but now you have gone.
Oh, there's a lot of chair dancing going on in the studio this evening, because tonight we're now moving on and looking at The Drums, the new memoir from Smith's drummer Mike Joyce. It arrives into a landscape where books about that band have often been fraught. From Morrissey's own highly stylized autobiography to Johnny Marr's acclaimed memoir. But Joyce takes a different route here, charting the rise, the fracture and legacy of one of the most influential guitar bands of the 1980s. His account sheds fresh light on the personal dynamics inside the Smiths, the band's deep Irish roots and the friendships that indeed shaped their sound. Eamon Sweeney, settle down there now. Stop singing, stop dancing in your chair. You've been reading The Drums. You're joining us now to tell us all about it. You might start, though, by reminding us of the significance of this band. I mean, it's nearly four decades and we still care. Why do we care?
There's one little fact that I'd forgotten about that Mike Joyce recalls in the book, that when Meat is Murder, which is kind of the second Smiths album, came out, and obviously because of its title and Morrissey's very kind of militant vegetarianism, made headlines. But that album knocked Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA off the number one spot in the UK.
Gosh.
Which is astonishing.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten about that, you know? The Smiths, in terms of a cultural relevance, they were one of the great 80s bands. It's as simple as that. Funny enough, I was slightly too young for them at the time, though I still remember Top of the Pops when Shoplifters of the World came out, and it is just completely blowing my mind. And I kind of got into them retrospectively after they split up. Mm-hmm. But my God, for those albums, for that only 4 or 5 year period, the music they released, certainly, especially I think in Ireland and England, and the Irish heritage of the band, and the fact they toured places, played in Limerick, played in Omagh, played in Letterkenny, you know, touring bands did not do that. And they still don't do that. But the Smiths did. And the Smiths really are one of those very, very special once in a generation kind of bands.
Okay, so you've reminded us why they matter, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the problem around the Smiths is you've the music and then you've the melodrama. You've the soap opera that goes on and on. And we've been waiting a little bit for this version of the events.
Absolutely.
Because there's four people in this band.
Yes.
And this is now another account, a first person kind of account of what happened. So just remind us about that soap opera and why the Smiths ended so acrimoniously when they were on such a high music.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing that Mike Joyce says today, and it's the one thing that all four members of the band, and one has died now in 2023, Andy Rourke passed away at the age of 59. But they all agree that their last album is their favourite and they think they're best, that they're onto a sound. And they've said, we should have done at least one more album. Basically, what happened was Johnny Marr convened the band for fish and chips in Notting Hill in London, in Neil's shop, and essentially said, that's it, I'm out. And what really, the pressure that was on Johnny Marr, and one of the things that comes across as like almost a subtext in The Drums, is the Smiths were a band without conventional modern management there, that's a double-edged sword, because it brought out the big personalities and obviously this amazing music, but it made them essentially at the end of the day almost unmanageable, and it all fell on Johnny to do all the heavy lifting on that. And Johnny, you know, the band started getting successful when he was 19, and he's about 23, 24. He's a young man, and he'd had enough. And that's basically why, that was the first split. Later, after the band had split up, it was Mike Joyce, who wrote this book, the drummer, who took Morrissey and Marr to court over unpaid royalties of $1 million and won in the High Court. So that was the second big chapter of that melodrama. And ever since, Morrissey's barbs towards Joyce have been hilarious at times, very, very withering in that classic Morrissey way.
Well, he's acidic like no one else.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that at times makes him very, very entertaining, maybe sometimes very, very frustrating. Also, another thing, I think in recent years, what Smiths fans and Morrissey fans have to contend with is his politics, you know, is, you know, it's more than centre-right, shall we say. He endorsed a fringe political party called For Britain that was called by some people, had in its membership Nazis and racists. By the way, who said that? Who said called that for a bit was actually Nigel Farage. That gives you an indication of kind of, you know, how far to the right this party perceived to be.
But I'm going to stop you there because already we're slipping into that thing of kind of only focusing on Morrissey. And the whole point of this,
absolutely,
right?
Yes.
I was really struck by a phrase that Mike Joyce said. He said, I wanted this book to be about the majesty of it, how it was wonderful and interesting and crazy and weird, not the negatives. So the book is that time. It's about the music and it's about what happened kind of on stage as such.
Absolutely.
Talk us through what you read. What do you see on the read on the pages?
What I see and what he sets out in the preface, and I think he receives... He delivers on this ambition remarkably well. It's a love letter to two things, to that time and also to the band. And when he says to that time, what he means by that is it was a time of a real vibrant counterculture that we were not connected in the modern way. You know, we didn't have internet, we didn't have mobile phones, we didn't have social media. But the counterculture that we shared and via record shops, via the weekly music press, via John Peel, It was loved by millions. It was a proper community of alternative music, you know, fans and freaks and weirdos.
And that's on the pages here. He absolutely brings you back.
Yes.
You're nearly smelling, you know, the vinyl, the musty shops and all that kind of thing. So he was there. He was the drummer. So he has this story of being involved with the band from the start. But the spotlight's on Morrissey, the spotlight's on Johnny Marr. But himself... but he was there at the back as the drummer all the way through. He's now telling the story, he's getting his turn. You've already mentioned the court case. How does that bit of the story work? Or is that just to the side on? Is he really focused on the music?
He's quite, I think he doesn't explicitly address the court case per se. In Morrissey's book, and I hate to go back to Morrissey too much, but he goes into it in great detail. You would expect that this would be Mike Joyce a kind of opportunity to set the record straight if he wanted to, but no.
Mike Joyce and Rourke thought they were in this for the same amount of money as the other pair. There was a contract signed innocently and they began to realise, hang on a minute, financially we're losing out here.
Basically the problem stemmed from them not signing a contract as four members, and that contract of Rough Trade Records with the Smiths was with Morrissey and Marr. And that essentially signed so much away. And there's one revealing kind of passage in the book that kind of Joyce recalls of someone in Rough Trade contacting him, going, "By the you know, you and Andy's share of the band has to be reduced." And he just flatly refused. No, even though he was a young man, he was very financially naive, very naive in general. But there's no way that he could accept this. But you know, he just kind of stayed true to his guns. But still, after, you know, I suppose he realised... The interesting thing that he really puts down on the page is from the very first rehearsal, he calls it out very early on. He says, musically, the Smiths was me, Andy and Johnny. Morrissey is the lyricist. And he was a brilliant lyricist. And this is the smart thing that Mike does. He eulogises Morrissey. He big ups Morrissey. He says his talent is so unique. But there's a very funny passage where he mentions that, because him and Andy became best friends. And Andy said to him one day about the previous day's rehearsal that him and Morrissey shared the bus ride home. And Morrissey did not utter a single word, to the point where, to pass the time, Andy Rourke was looking out the window of suburban Manchester counting lampposts It had got that. And it's told with such humour and such...
But that disconnection, Morrissey and the rest of the band was clear and stark, and he doesn't shy away from that here.
Absolutely.
So he's doing the double job. He's celebrating the artist of Morrissey, and he's not being bitter or begrudging about that, but he's explaining, but this was a really complex person to have in your life at a young age.
Absolutely, absolutely. You
know?
And
talk to us about the Irish connection, because we know about this. We know about the Gallagher brothers, you know, this thing of being Manchester Irish, that first generation connection with the Irish community. Mike Joyce talks about this in the book, the Irish roots that the band had.
Oh, quite a lot. And basically, you know, he reveals, and I suppose hardcore Smiths fans would kind of know this already, but they're all second generation Irish. And all of them, had, you know, both sides of the family and both parents were Irish, with the exception of Andy Rourke's, where his mother is English, but his dad was Irish.
Right.
So it's been said, I can't remember who exactly said it, but if you based the national identity of the band on parentage when they're born, they're more Irish than you too. They're the most Irish band.
That's like the cheekiest one.
It is
but
a little bit.
Like, last year, I remember Johnny Marr toured the show band era in Ireland. Like, he went back to the nightclub. Do you remember last summer where his parents had met?
Yes.
Like, this was really real to these people.
I'm very lucky to have... I've interviewed Johnny, I've interviewed Mike, but I also met Andy. And I pay him... DJed with a friend of Andy's, and I've met Morrissey. So I've met all the Smiths, which is my teenage...
That's your bucket list done.
Yeah, that bucket list was done. And I always found Johnny in particular to be so generous with his time. What Johnny has done, and I think Mike is looking towards that in this book. Johnny has very, very successfully ignored, rather than getting into a slag off at Morrissey, just focused on being Johnny Marr.
Okay.
Whereas this is kind of similar. But he doesn't have the benefit of Johnny Marr can sing. He's obviously one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He can tour on his own. Mike can't, but he's written a really good book. And he's going to bring it out. He's bringing it out in the road in the UK at the moment. He's coming to Ireland for Galway, Dublin and Belfast dates in April. This is a fascinating second act of a love letter to a great band that he was in.
You loved this band, right? But did you learn from this book? Like, were there gaps filled, or was it more just a nostalgia fest for you?
Good question. Yes, was there a bit of a nostalgia fest? Yes. What I did learn is...
I have this image of you correcting facts along the way. Actually, Mike, I think you'll find.
Well, he was there and I wasn't, I suppose, in a way. Or as he put it to me when I interviewed him, he has the privilege of having the best seat in the house for watching the Smiths rise. Because you can see the whole crowd, you can see everything. Mm. And all those performances were wild, and there's all the flowers and all this complete... It was amazing. It sounds absolutely amazing. It brought all that really alive for me. Can almost smell those flowers.
Yeah.
But also that just what we were discussing there about that disconnect of the singer and the musicians. Also, another thing that the drums does really, really well is it gives you that sense of, you know, this just doesn't fall out of the air. There's hours and hours of rehearsal. There's the drudgery of that. And there's the kind of the friction of young men, you know, being. And he says what he kind of mourned when Johnny left the band, because he said for 5 years of my life, he was like one of my best friends. And I saw him literally every single day, you know, not just once a week or every other day, every day. And you're traveling together, you're doing everything together. And it captures that very well. And in the preface, he kind of says, no one will understand what it's like to be in the Smiths more than being in the Smiths, or being in any band, he says. So he brings stuff like that really, like, very simple stuff. Even the fact the title is great, Drums by Mike Joyce. And on all those classic records, it says just, you know, the bass, Andy Rourke, the drums, and it's just keeping through that, which, of course, is Morrissey's idea in the first place. But anyway.
Very difficult question for you now, right? But I think you're well able for it. Does he help reposition how we all think about the band's musical engine beyond the usual Morrissey Marr kind of mythology, the narrative? He does that.
Definitely.
That's a success
for
you. Okay.
And what for me, what it did is I went back to tracks where the bass and the drums is really prominent, especially, let's say, The Queen is
You
Bell,
wanted to hear it.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
What a great music book should do, or A Lot Is Meat Is Murder, Barbers and Begins at Home, all those kind of classic, the bass and drums and that, it's just, you know, unparalleled.
My goodness. Well, look, it sounds like you're absolutely enthusiastic about it. It sounds like an excellent Christmas stocking.
Yeah.
Moment
I'd reckon,
going
like
on
if
here.
There's a Smiths fan in your life, I think this would be a good idea. It should be a hit.
Okay, well, listen, we're going to leave it there, but we'll say goodbye to, we'll take another little clip, another soundtrack from The Smiths there, but just while we're lining that up, I want to thank you, Eamon Sweeney, the drums. So Mike Joyce is out now. Okay. And Mike Joyce, as you said, will be on an Irish book tour next April. He'll be thrilled to be with that. He'll be in the Roisin Dove in Galway, Limelight in Belfast and the Sugar Club in Dublin. More details on mikejoyce.com. But here's another flavour of The Smiths. The pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take me out. Agus Fáilte Raiscítí Arena Anocht Ar Íhadzé Luan with me, Evelyn O'Rourke. Now, it's a classic film made exactly 80 years ago, and some claim it to be Joan Crawford's greatest role, playing the eponymous Mildred Pierce. It's a story of female empowerment, dastardly men, and tremendous shoulder pads. Ruth Barton joins me now to talk about why this film, Mildred Pierce, directed by Michael Curtis, has such an enduring appeal and still speaks to modern audiences. And it was a film, Ruth, which was banned by the Irish censors when it was first released. So let's get into this dark, dark film and tell us first, remind us a little bit about who Mildred Pierce is and what happens in this particular film.
Yeah, so this is quite a complex film because it's kind of a film noir. So if you love your film noirs...
There's a lot going on, I think, yeah, is what you'll mean. Know a lot of genres.
Yeah, you know that isn't like a sort of simple tagline approach.
No.
But so it starts with a murder because it's a film noir, sort of. And we don't know who's done it, but the police have their suspicions. So they pull in Mildred Pierce, the character who's played by Joan Crawford, because they may or may not suspect it's her. Or they may or may not suspect it's her husband, or her former husband, but they're not kind of letting on. So they pull her into the police station and she's dressed in her fantastic shoulder pad.
We don't like approve of real fur coats, obviously, anymore, but my goodness.
Oh, no, we don't. But on the other hand, it hangs.
She wears that coat.
And so we then get the story of what happened through flashbacks. And so it's always going to be delayed who did the murder. But in fact, you kind of almost forget that you want to know who did the murder because you get so absorbed in the story of how we got to this murder. And it's basically a rags to riches story. It starts off with her and her husband falling out. She's got these two kids. Mm-hmm. One is her gorgeous younger kid, who is 10, is a real tomboy called Kay. But the older one is the star of the show. She is some vixen. And this is Vida. And Vida, played by Anne Blythe, is a spoilt little madam, to put it mildly. And the real problem is she's loved too much by her mum, who would do anything for her. So did she actually kill him for her? Well, we will find out at the end.
Well, we have a little clip here just to give people a sense of what happens in this film. And here, as you say, we've a little conversation between Mildred and Vida, the spoiled teenage daughter. And here Mildred confronts her daughter, Vida, who has found Mildred's waitress uniform. So Mildred's taken this job to earn money, decent, honest work, as they saved it back in the day for her. And she's given it to Lottie, their maid.
You've been snooping around ever since I got this job, trying to find out what it is. And now you know. You know, don't you?
Know what? Know what, Mother?
You knew when you gave that uniform to Lottie that it was mine, didn't you?
Your uniform?
Yes, I'm waiting tables in a downtown restaurant.
My mother, a waitress.
I took the only job I could get so you and your sister could eat and have a place to sleep and some clothes on your backs.
Aren't the pies bad enough? Did you have to degrade us?
Vida, don't talk like that.
I'm really not surprised. You've never spoken of your people, who you came from, so perhaps it's natural. Maybe that's why, Father...
I'm sorry I did that. I'd have rather cut off my hand. I'd never have taken the job if I hadn't wanted to keep us all together. Besides, I wanted to learn the business the best way possible.
What kind of business?
The restaurant business. I'm planning on opening a place of my own. There's money in a restaurant if it's run right.
You mean we'll be rich?
Because that's all she cares about.
Eyes on the prize for Vida, isn't it? But so that's what's the women in the film, right? So we have Mildred and we have the two daughters, and Vida's obviously a driving part of the story. So we have them. Then we have the men. A lot of husbands knocking around here.
Yeah.
Watching the film, like, it's from what, 1944, 1945?
1945.
Yeah, there's a lot of action for Mildred Pierce going on here, you know, which is probably why it led to it being censored, led to it being banned, because it really gets dark and messy and deep down and dirty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And there's a very interesting kind of theme running through it about marrying for money. Mm-hmm. And so you know, marriage is a transaction very, very clearly. The film makes that very clear. You marry for money or you get rid of your husband because he's not producing money. So in the beginning, the first husband, who's a kind of decent fella but useless. So he's not bringing in the cash. And so...
The kind description.
Yeah, but he's... Yeah. So he's not bringing in the cash. So we get... She, you know, they separate. And then... So then... There's a question about who's she going to, what she's going to do. There's Wally, the ex-business partner, and he's kind of making a pitch for her, but she's saying, no, you know, look, you know, we're not in love. And oh, brilliantly... love? What? Money is what it's about.
But she's brilliantly standing on her own feet, and we're cheering her, right? Because she becomes a waitress and she takes on this world. But she, meanwhile, has this whole other agenda. She wants the money too. She wants a nice life too.
She wants the money, but she wants it for Vida. So then enter the real cad of the piece, Monty Berrigan, who is wealth. He's old money fallen on hard times. And so he's got this property that he can't afford to keep. She then turns it into a restaurant. And Wally is the one who negotiates the deal. And so Monty Berrigan is like total cad. And there are some real cartoon characters in this movie. And he's, you know, you just look at him and you know he's bad news. But for some bizarre reason, she falls for him. They have a relationship and, you know, we know it's going to end badly, and it surely does. And because this is also, I'm not too worried about giving away the plot too much.
I think 80 years on, we're okay.
I think we can do
a spoiler alert.
Is probably fair enough. There's always a point in these kind of movies where the woman gets punished for having stepped out of line. And in this case, the younger daughter coughs. And of course, sure as eggs are eggs, in a classic Hollywood movie, as soon as somebody coughs, they're going to die. And so she spends the night with Monty having, you know, passionate sex in his beachside hut. And then, of course, the next day, younger daughter is dead. And this is like, you know, the punishment.
So this is kind of classic story plotting.
It absolutely is.
She had to have this horrible punishment.
Yeah.
But it also maybe explains her devotion to Vida, because she has lost a younger daughter.
She tolerates
behaviour from Vida. That's quite astonishing. Really.
Oh, astonishing. She even did beforehand. But it does explain her throwing herself into her work as well, because she's trying to forget Kay. And so she works night and day. And she's really, really successful businesswoman. And the film is clearly articulating this, that there is this gap. I mean, the film is set a few years prior to it being released, actually set during World War II, then nothing actually, you don't see the war. But it does point out this is an opportunity for women to step out of their domestic roles and step into the business world. And that's one of the kind of classic social moments that gives rise to these strong women in film noir, because war ends, the men come back to the home, the men come back to work and they say, where are my jobs? And they shove the women back into the kitchen and they say, no, thanks very much. You were great, but you just go back to where you belong. And so you've got this huge kind of narrative of capable women who are now deeply resentful. And that's threaded through the film. And they reference it quite explicitly in a number of sequences. So she's very, very successful. But of course, meanwhile, Vida is conniving like crazy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she does is she sneaks off and gets married. So this is another marriage as transaction. She sneaks off. She marries this guy called Forrester, very wealthy family. And mum goes crazy. Forrester's mum goes crazy, hauls in Mildred Pierce and basically says, you know, My son has married beneath him. What are we?
This is all the class stuff that we maybe associate more with kind of British cinema. Or
yeah,
British narratives.
No, it's very
the American
much
stuff. It's really, I mean, it's really gritty about money and class.
Yeah, it completely, of course, associates money and class and occupation and where you live, because of course Mildred Pierce lives in this slightly anonymous suburb, and Monty has these magnificent houses. Monty Berrigan. So this guy's mum, Forrester's mum, calls Mildred Pierce and Vida in, and she has her posh lawyer there and says, you're out, you know. And Vida says, there's a small problem. I'm pregnant. You have to pay me to get rid of me. So everybody's furious with her, but she gets 10 grand, which in those, like...
I was thinking,
like,
big
10
money,
grand is big money. And then Mildred Pierce takes her back home and says, oh, you know, you poor thing, you must have been so stressed. Well, I might have been pregnant, but on the other hand, I might not be pregnant. And of course, so she's faked up the whole thing for the money. Mildred Pierce does the one kind of sensible thing, which is that she rips up the check.
Rips up the check. Well, I mean, there are other things she could have done with the check. But
money.
At the moment, the check is in ribbons on the floor.
The check is in ribbons on the
floor. And Vida's off.
Vida's chucked out at this point. But we know she'll have her back.
Because that's her whole motivation, right? So we move forward. And as we said, it starts, you know, in the present day of the movie as such. It goes through the flashbacks, through. And then we're starting, you know, to catch up on the story.
Yeah.
So basically, they're now in trouble. Mildred has married, gone back to Monty, fallen into his arms as a kind of a transaction, really.
Yeah, again, it's another transaction. So she rescues. So Wally, let's go back to Wally. Wally has seen an opportunity and he hires Vida in his nightclub doing sort of, you know, dancing, strip club type dancing. Mildred's husband, former husband, brings her into the nightclub to show her what their daughter is doing. Mildred is horrified and says, "You've got to come home." But she won't come home to her boring suburban home with her melamine furniture. So what Mildred does is she marries Monty for the status and for the big house. So again, it's more money transaction marriage.
So that Vida will come back.
Which
she does. Vida turns up with the suitcases, moves in, says, "I'll never say anything horrible again." And off we go into the next part of the movie.
That's right.
But it turns out Mildred and Monty, there's no love there really. That was a transaction.
No, it's pure transaction. And but on the other hand, he's, you know, interested in her money, particularly too, because she's so successful. But he's gambling like crazy. He promises to mend his ways. Of course, he doesn't. Vida is a constant drain on the family money. And she and Monty are being seen together at the racecourse. Uh-oh, what's Vida up to this time?
Another red flag.
Could she be after Monty? Is this kind of like some kind of almost incestuous subplot?
Mm-hmm.
Of course she is. We're almost catching up with ourselves at this point. Will we reveal what happened?
Well, let's just take a beat for a minute, because I think that's a lot about the story, but the context of the film.
No, for sure.
So we've Michael Curtiz, who is obviously the Oscar-winning director of Casablanca, turning his attention to this. The bit I want to talk to you about is Joan Crawford, because we have such respect for her.
Mm-hmm.
Watching the film, the echoes of Mommy Dearest is slightly in your mind, right? I'm sorry, it just
surely is.
Whatever. Yeah. I know that has a complicated context around it. But Joan Crawford won her Oscar, her only Oscar for this, but she wasn't the first choice.
No, Barbara Stanwyck was.
Amazing, isn't it?
So Barbara Stanwyck had been in Double Indemnity and had played that classic femme fatale. And it's, you know, Double Indemnity, hard to beat, an amazing film noir. But yeah, no, prior to that, Joan Crawford had been labelled a box office poison.
Because the films weren't making money.
The films were not making money. And of course, if you don't make money, you've got no value in Hollywood. I mean, she and a number of other classic actors, including Katharine Hepburn, for instance, were all labelled box office poison in this one particular article in 1938. And so she'd been demoted from being number one in Warner's studio. Michael Curtiz wants Barbara Stanwyck. Joan Crawford gets the role, and she is just stunning.
Magnificent in it.
Yeah, she really, and she.
She strides through it like no one else.
And
she owns every room in this.
She does, and she, you know, the way she kind of spits out her lines, and you just, you know, once you've seen it, you can't imagine anybody else in it. Massive career comeback for her.
And then she wins the all important Oscar, and she goes on to have kind of a great career for the decades after.
Yeah,
but just. In a way, it's hard to describe this film as just one thing because it is jumping around the genres. What makes it a noir? What makes it melodrama? You know, what? Where does it sit for you?
It is really a combination of the two. So it's that. So if you think about the kind of classic woman's film melodrama of this period, 1940s, it's about a woman, usually a woman who's wronged, who falls into temptation and who is really punished by patriarchy for having...
dared to step
out of her place and have wanted more than she should have. So that's the kind of classic, and that's, you know, Barbara Stanwyck and Double Indemnity, and in the course in the film noir they become killers. So it's got all of that, and it's also got the kind of black and white characters like Monty Berrigan, the cad, in it, and you know who they are. At the same time, and I think we all love our film noir, it's shot like a film noir. So it's got these, it's obviously a black and white film, but it makes huge use of shadow and light.
Car lights tell a whole other story.
That's right. And mirrors. It loves its mirrors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mirrors in these films signal the kind of duplicity of somebody, because if you're not seeing them directly, but... And it's that kind of trick where you think you're looking at them, but then you realise you're looking at them in the mirror. So the mirror shows they've got this other side to them.
I have to say, watching it, I wasn't surprised that at the time it was banned, because we know about the culture that was here at that time. What was so shocking about it? Why did the Irish censors decide to ban this film?
Well, because it's such a great movie. Here's what the here's what the censors said about it. This is a sordid, unsavoury picture. The sanctity of marriage is treated as a joke, and moral considerations of any kind are ignored. Seductive situations, dubious dialogue, murder, and an accommodating husband are minor features of this film. Does that not make you want to see it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the best ad for the film.
Really. Oh, it is, yeah.
I mean, that's nearly angry, isn't it? It's outraged.
He was actually a very articulate film censor. Yeah. When he really didn't like something, he really, you know, told you why not. Because it was banned, and then it was appealed, and then he said no, and so Irish audiences were not to be misled in life by seeing this kind of filth.
As we all rush to YouTube, have a quick look at it there. Well, that we're discussing there, Mildred Pierce, on her its 80th birthday, unbelievably, 1945. Ruth Barton, thank you so much for joining us this evening to celebrate the 80th birthday of the Oscar-winning performance there from Joan Crawford in Mildred Pierce. Take it away, Lily Allen.
You don't touch me. Still so needy. And I don't know if you do it intentionally. Somehow you make it my fault. You don't stop talking. And I'm just sleepwalking. Cause I'm angry, cause I'm hurt. Looking back, it's so absurd. Cause I trusted you and took you at your word. Who said romance isn't dead? Been no romance since we wed. Why aren't we fucking, baby? Yeah, that's
Lily Allen singing Sleepwalking there from her new album, of course, West End Girl. Now, in 1697, a play called The Mourning Bride, that has a U in it, by William Congreve, had a line which has resonated with the audience and resonated so much that we haven't stopped quoting it since then. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. And from Euripides' Medea to Stephen King's Carrie, there are endless examples of centuries of scorned women enacting revenge. And singer Lily Allen, you heard it there, her latest album, every track was an act of revenge. And it's the latest trope, really. She married that actor David Harbour after meeting on a celebrity dating app called Raya. They were married by Elvis in Las Vegas. Then she and her two daughters moved to New York to an over-designed brownstone, some would say, which was featured on a famous tour by the married pair on an Architectural Digest video. But then we learned it was all over. Lily returned to London and months later emerged with this album. It's a devastating takedown of her former husband and his peccadillos, I think it's a fair way to say it, a very polite way to say it. I'm delighted to say that Louise Bruton joins me now, having spent the last couple of weeks listening to the album, and she's chosen other examples of a woman scorned too. This is very much in keeping with our theme this evening with Mildred Pierce a few minutes ago. So Louise, when we look at something like West End Girl, like how much of it is fact? How much of it is true about this revenge, these music here and the lyrics?
So a thing that has come into my mind an awful lot about a woman's revenge, is it always revenge or is it a woman's truth? And the big thing about...
Oh, I like it.
One thing about the truth in this album that Lily Allen is letting everybody know is that this album was inspired by her marriage to David Harbour, but not all of it is truth. Not all of it should be taken as gospel, which seems like a very good way to let her explore the full artistic license as a songwriter, but also to protect herself from whatever lawyers could be knocking down her door. We are brought back to the beginning of her marriage on the opening track, West End Girl, which is a very fun kind of bossa nova, almost musical style song, where we were introduced to that brownstone that you described there. And then suddenly there's a change in their marriage when she is cast in a play and he, as an actor, isn't so supportive of the fact that now she's getting this success in his lane. And that's when their marriage begins to break down. But it's more of a one-sided breakdown, because according to the album, he requested that they have an open relationship, something that she isn't happy about.
Mm-hmm.
And the album then goes through the deception, the infidelity, the double life that he was able to lead, and her always trying to play the woman that he wanted her to be, losing herself. And that song, Sleepwalking, gorgeous song, is about her battling insomnia, kind of just all of the voices in her head trying to figure out what's going on, and it eventually takes its toll on her mentally and physically.
It's a fabulous video, actually. She's walking down the street with a big quilt wrapped around her, which looks very tempting for a Monday, I have to say. But anyway, that's a really big example, and that's grabbing the headlines at the moment. But this is not the first time that women have used song and literature to exact revenge. There's a long history of women getting even, you know, about in using their stories in popular culture. Talk us through some of the big examples, maybe the big screen music, ones that stand out to you.
Okay, well, I might just, well, with Sleepwalking, the first image that I had of that is one of the biggest kind of literary texts of kind of feminism and kind of an example of gaslighting. And it's The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Wilman, written in 1901. A husband deems his wife to be insane, so she's locked away in a bedroom. She begins to see the wallpaper moving, the yellow wallpaper, and she can see a woman crawling through the print on the paper. She believes herself that she is that woman, and she declares that she is free. So the idea of your liberation or your freedom coming can be in different forms. And that woman, she was not free, but in her mind, she certainly was free.
But if we're going from, say, that's the literary end of it, right? Can I bring it to Whitney Houston? Because there's the fun pop part of it too, right? And popular culture. So say, for example, Whitney, that song, It's Not Right. You don't really hear the lyrics till you think about it. And then when you examine the lyrics, my goodness, they're brutal.
So this whole concept of checking the receipts, which is something that Lily Allen also does on this album, on the song 4chan Stand, she goes through her husband's bedside locker, finds receipts for expensive bags that she never received, weekendaways that she never went on. And this is exact same thing in Whitney Houston's track, which was written by Rodney Jenkins, A Man Will Forgive It. But the lyric is, she found receipts and says, if six of y'all went out, then four of you were really cheap because only two of you had dinner. I found your credit card receipt. It's such a brilliant reflection of what she could have been going through at the time with her marriage mm-hmm. to Bobby Brown. Famously very volatile couple, usually in the headlines for all sorts of carry-on. So this song, even though it wasn't written by Whitney, its narrative fit in what we believed of Whitney's life, which is a common thing to happen now in a lot of modern pop songs, where a lot of women are kind of getting their gotcha moment for men who are cheating on them, usually leaving them for much younger wives. There's a fantastic example of Shakira in 2023, who is married to the Barcelona football player Gerard Piqué, and when she discovered there was a third person in the relationship, she released a rap song, which was just a video rap, sort of like a fun collaboration that she did with the producer Bizarrap. And she raps in Spanish saying things like, I'm worth two 22-year-olds. You traded in a Ferrari for a Twingo. You traded in a Rolex for a Casio. And it's one of her biggest hits in recent years. One of the biggest Spanish songs in recent years as well. And it floored him.
I'm now with Emma Thompson crying in the bedroom. Do you remember in Love Actually when she gets the necklace and she's just sobbing? And it's the Joni Mitchell album is what he's actually given her instead of the necklace. Oh my God, I'm getting emotional about all this. Now talk to us, Beyonce, of course.
Beyonce, of course. So it's very hard
Becky
not to
hair,
think about
yeah.
Beyonce, as she name checked Becky with the good hair, because on Lily Allen's album, we've been named a woman, a fictional woman, or a combination of multiple women. Her name is Madeline, and Lily Allen does this brilliant repetition going, who is Madeline actually in the song? And it's this sort of kind of Easter egg breadcrumbing in these songs, where we're trying to figure out the timeline of a marriage, the timeline of a relationship of these high profile people. They may not be able to confirm or deny anything in interviews, nor do they want to, so they put their own stories into their music. So there were rumors of Jay-Z's infidelity when he's still married to Beyonce, and in an excellent twist, she was able to put him in his place in one of the biggest albums of her career. In the final song on that album, Formation, she says, come on ladies, the best revenge is your paper, as in the best revenge is your success, the best revenge is your money. And in a way, she is now the more successful member of that couple, and her revenge has been success and beating him in the game.
Right, we might have a little creeping sound of that in the background as we start to say goodbye to you, Louise. Thank you so much for sharing all that information and reminders of Beyonce. There she is, doing her thing back here at the hair. So that's our lot for this evening. I'm Evan Rourke signing off for you this evening. Our producer this evening was Sinead Egan. Research was by Paula Shields. The broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. The sound supervision was by Gar Duffy.